Welcome back to another episode of Wicked Hot, everybody. This is John.
And Kevin.
And this week, guys, we are bringing you another episode of beautiful, beautiful content. And honestly, this week's episode is, the topic is inspired by a wrong answer to one of our Instagram posts by my brother. And Kevin, which post was it for which episode?
So it was the episode where we talked about movie mistakes. And we posted a picture of Johnny Depp and a guy with a cowboy hat just standing in the background in Pirates of the Caribbean. So your brother guessed sinking franchises. We posted this week a picture of, I thought people would get this. We posted a picture of, Aang, I think is his name, whatever the character's name.
Okay.
Last Airbender. And the correct answer was franchises that came from nothing and franchises that were supposed to happen but never did.
I'm excited for this week. As always, you know the format. Kevin and I will be going over four movies total, two franchises that sunk and two franchises that came out of nothing. So grab your popcorn and let's get into another episode of Wiki Hot Movie Mayhem.
Wicked smart, wicked cool, wicked fucking stupid, whatever the fuck, something wicked.
My boy's wicked smart.
The boy is hotter than hot. He's hot,
hot, hot!
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
My first film I'm covering went from revived to dead to revived to dead, suffering development hell and ultimately its eventual demise. And I'm talking about Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes. A cinematic masterpiece in 2001.
The one with Mark Wahlberg?
It is the one with Mark Wahlberg as a scientist yet again. The he most poorly.
That?
Tim Burton?
Yeah. He did? Wow.
He did. Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Horribly miscast for as Mark Wahlberg as a scientist. I mean,
but they still
don't know why
do
people,
it.
People
still do it.
Wasn't he a scientist in Transformers, the new one?
I don't know. I never saw it. Thankfully, I never saw it. But he was a scientist in The Happening.
All right. I guess he wasn't that much of a scientist. But either way, I feel like they put him in too high of like intelligence jobs, not just scientists. And, you know, he's a blue collar guy. So,
yeah, he needs to be playing like, you know, he always plays the detective in Departed. He needs to play like the beat cop.
He does. He really does. In order to talk about the inexistent Tim Burton franchise, though, you have to go back to the 1968 Planet of the Apes and the impact that film had specifically on Fox in the 80s. Writer Adam Rifkin, and if people who don't know who he is, he wrote Small Soldiers and Mouse Hunt. Terrible movies, but two of my childhood favorites in the 90s.
Wow.
Do you know Small Soldiers?
I do know Small Soldiers, and I watched it. Like a year ago, probably a year ago.
Does it still hold up?
It does not
I've
hold
heard mixed.
No, okay, it does not hold up.
And have you seen Mouse Hunt? That's with Nathan Lane.
Yes.
I'm sure that movie still holds up. I'm convinced. But in any case, Adam Rifkin, he had an idea for Planet of the Apes to make Fox the same amount of returns as Aliens did for Alien, which enticed Fox because he flashed those dollar signs in front of their face and they were 100% in. But that's a bold statement to be like, I'm going to be basically the James Cameron to Ridley Scott.
Yeah, I mean, that's James Cameron walking in writing Aliens with a dollar sign on a chalkboard. Like, that's the equivalent of what he did for Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. Waving dollar signs is one thing, but the idea of the new franchise was tossed around to basically every big actor and director at the time. Fox wanted to make sure they got this shit right. Tom Cruise and Charlie Sheen were contending for the lead role until basically the Fox leadership shifted and all the new execs didn't like the direction of Adam Rifkin's writing.
Okay.
They ended up hiring Peter Jackson and he was involved in concept and writings for the franchise, but ultimately it was dropped.
Isn't Peter Jackson a producer on the movie?
No, he wasn't, because when the movie came out, that's the same time Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring came out. So,
yeah,
as you know, that's his, yeah, that's his thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Eventually in 1993, though, Fox signed on Oliver Stone as executive producer and hired Terry Hayes, who, if you don't know who Terry Hayes, he co-wrote Mad Max 2 Road Warrior and wrote Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And they hired him to write the script, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was signed on for the lead role.
What?
Yeah. But the studio and the writer had creative differences again, so Fox completely scrapped that idea. Oliver Stone ended up dropping out because of this, and Chris Columbus, who's the director for Home Alone and Harry Potter 1
yep,
and 2.
Yep.
Your favorite two of the series.
The least the least badass wizard of all time is the first Dumbledore.
But Chris Columbus came on board with co-writer Sam Hamm. Once again, Fox wasn't enthused about the writing direction and dropped him and Chris Columbus.
It's insane that they dropped all of these really good writers and directors and settled on what they settled on. Like, yes. That was the best idea they had.
So get this. Finally in comes William Broyles Jr. If you don't know who this is, he wrote Apollo 13, Castaway, Jarhead, Flags of Our Fathers, Polar Express, and he wrote the screenplay that attracted our eventual director, Tim Burton, to the series.
Oh boy.
Fox producer Richard Zanuck supported the movie, and interestingly enough, his late father, Daryl Zanuck, was the founder and president of Fox, who greenlit the original Planet of the Apes in 1968. So I'm thinking this is more of like a emotional move rather than, I'm going to give you a chance. Just like, oh shit, my dad did this. And hey, you know, the script is pretty decent, I guess, when it was written at the time. Obviously, it went through a bunch of rewrites because for some reason, Fox was super neurotic with how they were going to release this movie. But after all that happened, everything was going in a positive direction for them. They thought that this was going to become a huge franchise. And honestly, on opening weekend, it kind of was. It made $68 million, which is $97 million in today's dollars. And it ended up making three times its budget at $362 million worldwide. I will say, though, the cons were a bit overwhelming. It was a generic blockbuster with a known IP. And Tim Burton has openly been against the movie. He said that he originally wanted a $200 million budget, but he was only given $100 million. And apparently the production of the film itself was rushed because Fox just wanted to get it out.
They wanted to make it a blockbuster or something?
Yeah, they wanted to get it out as quickly as possible. But it received mixed reviews and was basically hated by audiences for its generic human heroes and shit story. Fox surprisingly called it quits and decided not to proceed with more films despite the amount of money that they made.
Wow.
It's just it's crazy that they made a shit ton of money and somehow a studio listened to the audience for once and didn't continually try to shove content we don't want down our throats for a quick buck.
Yeah. I have an unpopular opinion, and I actually like the ending of the Tim Burton movie.
I don't think... Oh, so speaking of which, Tim Roth explained the ending pretty recently.
Oh, okay.
Basically, what happens is that Tim Roth's character, General Thade, finds out how to use the spaceship. And so he follows Mark Wahlberg and also gets sent through a black hole.
Oh,
except
okay.
His black hole ends up on human Earth in the fucking like 1800s. And he basically leads an uprising. And that's why we're basically seeing like 250 years into the ape future when Mark Wahlberg finally arrives. So basically, even though
it's
he
like
left
he started
after
a time loop or something.
Right. Even though Mark Wahlberg left after General Thade, he still arrived after that Thade arrived, even though, you know, whatever. Or I'm sorry, he left before Thade and got there after him.
So the actual end makes you believe that Mark Wahlberg just went back to a different, like a different timeline or something.
Well, so he was going back to his original timeline and Tim Roth's character gets there before him and basically just changes everything. So by the time he lands there, it's completely different.
Yeah. Damn. That would have been nice to have explained. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it explained it that way at all.
No. I'm pretty sure this was Tim Roth's interpretation, but after hearing it, I'm like, damn, I want that. That sounds awesome.
That's an awesome fan theory.
I will say that's the only thing that people actually liked because it wasn't just a generic thing. I mean, people were confused, but it was something leading up to something, right?
Yeah.
So speaking of money, it's ironic because the 2001 rendition of Planet of the Apes still to this day has grossed more domestically than any of the other Planet of the Apes films adjusted for inflation, even the newest one.
Really?
2001 Planet of the Apes has made more money, not combined, but more money each time domestically. Only domestically, though.
Wow.
Which is insane.
Because the newer ones are pretty good.
Yeah, I think they have the highest like resurgence as far as not tomato meter score, because I mean, that doesn't really matter. But I'm saying like critic and audience score combined. Popularity. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, this kind of it's a little bit revolutionary in the not revolutionary, but more of humbling to see that Fox passed on this. But I also just think it's that franchises, reboots, remakes were kind of non-existent at this time when all of this was being developed, and maybe that's how Fox was just able to abandon the franchise for further movies, just because that was something that really wasn't seen yet, or studios hadn't seen. I mean, I guess aside from Star Wars, the popularity of it.
Yeah. I don't understand why they would abandon it if it made a decent amount of money. I just don't.
Yeah.
If it made money, like it's nowadays, if something makes money, it's like, fuck, make franchises, make sequels, spinoffs. Yep.
Cinematic universe, universes.
Yep.
I do vaguely remember, I mean, despite, you know, it was pretty decent. I mean, they had great makeup effects. I mean, it was Rick Baker, legend Rick Baker makeup. And again, Tim Roth was fucking awesome in it, which, by the way, that was like a new thing for me. I had no idea that the main ape bad guy was Tim Roth.
I didn't either.
Yeah.
Wow. The makeup is very good. And it probably had to have won an Oscar.
It did not, actually.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I don't even know if it was nominated, to be honest. He was nominated for a BAFTA award for Planet of the Apes and for a Saturn award, which is like the science fiction awards.
Uh-huh.
He was nominated in 2000 for the Jim Carrey, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and won an Academy Award, but wasn't even nominated for an Oscar for Planet of the Apes.
The makeup is so much better in
Planet of the Apes. I mean, the Grinch looks good, but that's like the only one is him. There's the Who people. But.
Yeah, well, I feel like it's harder to make a person look like a gorilla than a person look like a Who.
Because they literally look like gorillas.
Yeah.
It's not even...
Yeah.
I mean, there's no... The fact that that was a human underneath that is insane to me.
Yeah. I wonder if it holds up today. It's been a long time since I've seen that one. So my first one is a movie that was planned to be a franchise from the beginning. And this is a movie called A-Team, starring Liam Neeson and Rampage Jackson.
And Bradley Cooper. And that fucking South African guy.
Shota Coppola. He was actually one of the better actors in the movie.
I will agree with that.
Before the movie started shooting, they had already actually planned two sequels. So it was going to be a three-movie franchise, and they had all signed on for it. But the problem with the movie was before it even came out, they knew that it was going to be a disaster at the box office.
Really?
So the movie came out on June 11th, but in March...
Yeah, my birthday.
Yeah, in March... That year, they had already squashed the sequels. They had already squashed the entire franchise. Yeah. So Bradley Cooper was actually quoted with saying that the film is not going to generate enough money to warrant a sequel. And he said this in March of 2011 when the movie was coming out 3 months later. Literally 3 months later, he bashed it and said it's definitely not going to make enough money to get a sequel, which may have been something that killed it.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I don't think it was good by any means. It's definitely forgettable because I can't really remember anything of it. But I don't remember leaving there and being like, "Oh, that was just horrible. I can never."
That's what I'm saying. I saw it in theaters and I left the theater going, "That was a good action movie. That was a you know, it was a good action movie. It was a fun movie." I kind of understand where they're coming from because in 2012, Liam Neeson was quoted as saying, "I watched the movie and found it a little confusing, and I was even in the thing. I couldn't figure out who was who and what had been done to him and why." And that...
That's coming from someone who does, like, really shitty franchise
exactly.
movies.
So I'm thinking back on this, and after I read this quote from Liam Neeson, I'm like, you know what? Yeah, it doesn't explain, like, what happens and why it happens to him. Like, because that...
The movie starts with them all in turmoil, basically.
Yeah, it does. And
like we missed something.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know, just thinking back on it, the motivation is not there to warrant the entire second and third act of the movie. So it was a mess. And in 2013, when there were still some rumblings of them wanting to make a sequel, Carahan, the director, said... there will never be an A-Team sequel because the DVD sales were not good enough. So he's saying that everything hinged on the DVD sales. It wasn't the fact that it was just not a great movie. It was a very forgettable movie. The studio hated it. Bradley Cooper was bashing it 3 months before it was released. And he's like, oh, the DVD sales suck, so we couldn't make a sequel. No, it was a shit movie.
So I'm almost convinced that the studio probably sent a little feeler out for this article, quote unquote, that said, oh, in 2013, oh, we're still trying to make a sequel, throwing that out there to see if there's any
buzz.
Bites. Yeah.
Yeah, I could totally see that.
It clearly was, everyone was like, A-Team, what's that? Isn't that the show with Chuck Norris? Is Chuck Norris in it? I don't know if I'm...
Chuck Norris? No, he's not in A-Team.
My point exactly.
He's in Walker, Texas Ranger.
That's what I'm thinking of.
But the movie, this is insane to me. So the budget for the movie was $110 million. The movie only made worldwide box office, including Blu-ray and DVD sales, $177 million.
Oh my.
So it only made $50 million. And that was up until today when I got these numbers. So
basically they lost money, because if they're getting a dollar for something that happened yesterday, basic economics, a dollar is worth more today than tomorrow. That's just a fucking fact.
Yeah, and I don't know if this takes into account the marketing budget, because the marketing for A-Team was insane. I remember it had trailers all over TV. There was posters everywhere, even in Arizona where there's never movie posters. There were billboards with A-Team posters.
Yeah, they were really trying to... Honestly, it's kind of sad because I feel like the Peter Griffin Family Guy A-Team was way more memorable than this movie.
I 100% agree.
And if I will say this, I'm very surprised at the fact that Bradley Cooper, who's basically always said he doesn't want to be stereotyped into the pretty boy role, he signs on for a 3-movie franchise as the pretty boy role.
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
Yeah. It's basically his role from The Hangover, but
his role from The Hangover and Wedding Crashers. It's as if there was like Wedding Crashers 2, like Gone Co-Ed or something like that. Like,
yeah.
Bradley Cooper starring in it. The only one, Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson did not return for that one. But Bradley Cooper's just like, oh, I hate being the pretty boy. Wedding Crashers 2, Wedding Crashers 3.
Exactly. That's what this could have turned into. I'm glad it didn't, because, I mean, who wants another A-Team movie?
Yeah, who wants another shitty franchise? I surely do not.
Yeah.
My next one is definitely a weird one, because I never knew that when making this movie, that one, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, was part of a 20-book series
What?
About the nautical adventures of Russell Crowe's Captain Jack Aubrey and Paul Bettany, Stephen, I don't even know how to say this guy's last name, Maturin. Two, this movie was critically acclaimed and nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture, and one for cinematography and sound editing.
Wow. First of all, you blew my dick off with it being a book franchise first. And what
20
were they,
books, 20 books.
Were
dude.
They going into this with like a 20 movie vision on how they were going to do this shit?
So they used eight books for the main plot was one book, which was Master and Commander, but they took about eight different things from other books. So if they've already touched on things from other books, I'm wondering, they never said how many were supposed to be made.
Okay.
But the scenario got me thinking of critically acclaimed Oscar movies and how weird it would be if we had period piece films like this to be a franchise. I think of it, and if they had made an Amadeus 2, Salieri versus Beethoven, then that in itself may have tarnished all the reputation that the first had and still conjures up. But then I remembered we have Lord of the Rings and The Godfather, and those had sequels, and all of them were nominated for awards, except for Godfather 3, you know, my thoughts on Godfather 3. But it's interesting because Lord of the Rings Return of the King won the most awards to tie with Ben-Hur and Titanic, which was far superior to the latter two. But, you know, I digress. Cause
I think you're a little biased, but I do agree. I 100% agree.
Yeah. Also, we should have known that this would have been a sequel, considering for the first movie, they've already included a colon to precede the film name, a la Avengers or an MCU film. So you knew it was coming. I was fooled for the longest time. But then when I realized that I always, first of all, Master and Commander, colon, The Far Side of the World, that's too long of it. That's probably why it failed.
Yeah. Nobody's going like, yeah, I want to go see the new Master and Commander, colon, The Far Side of the World. Like, nobody's... Even saying Master and Commander is too long. You've already lost me.
Yeah. It sounds like a board game.
It does. It really does. And The Far Side of the World is like the expansion to the Master and Commander.
The expansion of Settlers of Catan.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's also weird because although the intent was to franchise this film, Master and Commander, they kind of already screwed themselves because, like I said, they borrowed certain scenarios from the other books rather than fully adapt just one single one like a normal fucking person would for a book adaption.
Yeah, you know what's always the complaint with book readers and movies is that they didn't have enough stuff from the book in the movie. How are you going to cover eight books in one movie? That's like, imagine if Harry Potter was in one movie. No, fuck that. No way.
So first year is like 15 minutes. Second year, there's like only highlights. It's like first 15 minutes, like, oh God, Professor Quirrell, oh, the chess game. And then second,
oh,
it's
that,
like,
remember that chess game? Yeah. It's like a Family Guy flashback.
The whole movie's Family Guy flashbacks. Back to Master and Commander. The film eventually came out in November in 2003. It had a $25 million opening weekend with a domestic gross of $93 million, so roughly $34 and $127 in today's dollars. Worldwide, it grossed $212 million,
okay,
which is good for an Oscar movie.
That is good.
But not so much for one that cost $150 million to make.
Oh, God. I knew so that was going to be an expensive movie when you said you were doing that. Yep.
Without the foreign audiences, this movie would have lost a shit ton of money. So it makes sense why the studio decided not to gamble a second time. Plus, you have the bloated cost and headache that it is to film at sea is enough for studios to make an easy call and pull on the plug and letting the ship sink. Pun most definitely intended. But despite this quick death to a potential franchise, Russell Crowe has been very vocal for years about how he wants there to be a Master and Commander 2 still.
And this is the guy that wanted Gladiator 2 Christ Killer.
Christ Killer, yes.
Yeah, when he recommends a sequel, nobody listens. They're just like,
has he been in sequel movies?
No, not that I can think of. They just sit him down.
Please finish
like,
your Russell thing.
Yeah, they're just like, Russell, do you remember Gladiator 2 Christkiller? Nobody wants to listen to a pitch about a sequel to a movie that you want to do.
Like Master and Commander 2, it's like Master and Commander 2, the far side of the underworld, where Captain Jack Aubrey goes to fucking find his dead friend amongst the Davy Jones. It's like a Pirates of the Caribbean crossover with Master and Commander. Fuck the Acheron. We're going after fucking the Flying Dutchman. I don't give a fuck.
Oh, man. That sounds like a Russell Crowe sequel. And if you haven't heard the synopsis for Gladiator 2 Christkiller, go back to our, I think, our second episode.
Yeah. Most recently in 2017, he tweeted a crazy tweet because, I mean, Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
That didn't make grammatical sense, but he, quote, heard whispers of a second voyage, end quote. Which is back to the thing. He's throwing it to see if there's going to be any buzz. It's like, fuck yeah, 500 retweets.
You might as well. That's what I'm saying. You might as well just post 1,000 retweets and we'll make Master and Commander 2.
But basically, since his appearance in the film, he said that he had continued to read the books and would love to revisit that world. So much so that since 2009, he has been speaking with the rights owner of the books in developing them onto film further. I guess that got nowhere because a year later, he flat out asked fans to email the president of Fox to have this movie made. Of course, he negated to actually give the email address to which he was referring.
Oh, yeah.
And despite Russell Crowe's petition to bring us back to the HMS Surprise, which is the ship in the movie, Fox isn't the only one that needs convincing. The first movie was made in conjunction with Samuel Goldwyn Films and Miramax as the production companies, as well as Universal, who had distribution on the international market. Plus, you still need the owner of the author, Patrick O'Brien's estate, to sign off on it too, making it to 5 separate entities to come together once again to make this movie.
No, that you're lucky it happened for one movie.
I do. I am kind of pissed off because after I think about this movie, it leaves us on a cliffhanger because they're still chasing that French ship. And I doubt,
yeah.
You know, it just.
Well, now it makes sense. At the time, I was like, motherfucker, we're never going to know what happens. I didn't know it was a 20 series book at the time.
Yeah, it's a good ending, but at the same time, it's just like, oh, well, I didn't know that there was more to the story, so let's fucking get going.
I guess if you see that ending and you know it's a 20 series book, you're like, fuck yeah, bring on Master Commander 2.
Not only will it not happen because of the 5 companies, but Russell bringing back, do you really think they could afford Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany? Especially Paul Bettany's in fucking Avengers now.
Yeah,
not to mention the cost
Paul
of filming Bettany's, on location.
Yeah, Paul Bettany's bigger than Russell Crowe is now.
At this point, yeah.
I'd rather have Paul Bettany in my movie. Not only because he's probably a pleasure to work with, but
yeah,
probably just a better actor in general.
Also, if you're going to franchise a movie nowadays, you need to make upwards of $500 million at the bare minimum to warrant the spend.
Yeah, except there's no way that, you know, a movie making $220 million is getting a sequel, let alone a franchise.
Yeah, a cinematic universe. Yeah. He wants the Master and Commander cinematic universe.
Yeah. So my next one is a blockbuster movie starring Johnny Depp and the biggest draw ever, Armie Hammer. And I'm talking about The Lone Ranger.
Oh, I thought we were going with Pirates.
No. So what's wrong with this movie is initially in that first sentence that I just said. The studio wanted Armie Hammer for this movie, and for whatever reason, they were planning on making multiple sequels. So we may have had like 4 or 5 Lone Rangers if this had done well.
So like Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right, yeah. So the demise of the movie, through no fault of his own, because I think Armie Hammer is a good actor, but Armie Hammer did not have the draw, and Johnny Depp also did not have the draw, because at that time he was making, that was like the fourth.
Johnny Depp was Johnny Depping.
Yeah, he was Johnny Depping hard, yeah.
Or Jack Sparrowing it, because I feel like at this point, that's like all his characters.
Yeah. So the movie was made for about $225 million, and it just grossed $260 million.
Oh my lord.
Which, I, looking back on the movie, I'm like, what the fuck cost $225 million? Like, you're in the desert in Utah. Like, what are you got? What is this money for?
Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp and Armie Hammer is probably like fifth on the list.
I was going to say, he's definitely like probably getting paid the union minimum for this.
He's making like the, like the rookie,
50 grand,
like the rookie
whatever.
Minimum or something, like the 250K. And Johnny Depp's making like 60 million, I guess. The problem, and I kind of agree with Depp here, so there was a interview with Johnny Depp about the possibility of a sequel and what happened with the first movie after it came out. And Depp said that, I think the reviews were written once they heard Gore Verbinski, a.k.a. the director of Mouse Hunt.
Oh.
And Jerry Bruckheimer were involved. So, if you don't know those two, they worked together on a bunch of Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Yep.
Mouse Hunt. And so Depp also said that the movie, even though Jerry Bruckheimer and Gore Verbinski were attached to it, and they are known for their blockbusters, he said that The Lone Ranger was not supposed to be a blockbuster movie. It was supposed to be kind of like an indie movie.
Oh, fuck him.
And I'm sitting there like, $225 million budget. Fuck you, Johnny Depp.
It was supposed to be an indie movie with an IP. Well, I mean, that's not really a popular IP, but an indie movie is, at least from what I can gather and remember, is an original film. Not one just like, yo, let's make an indie film about fucking Power Rangers or something. Like, what?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And that's reading that, I understand the first half. You know, the critics seeing, or the fan base seeing Jerry Bruckheimer involved and Johnny Depp, and they're all, you know, involved with Pirates of the Caribbean. I understand seeing that and thinking, oh, this is going to be a blockbuster. But it was marketed as a blockbuster. It came out during Blockbuster Month. Yeah. And it had a $225 million budget. Like, that is the definition of a blockbuster.
I agree.
And the fact that Depp says, I don't know why they had expectations of it being a blockbuster. Get the fuck out of here, dude. $10,000 a month wine bill. Like, get the fuck out of here. He is so Seriously? Out of touch. You didn't know that? It was like an interview.
Is that why he had that crazy cup when he was like, yeah, berating fucking, what's her face? What's her name?
Amber Heard.
Amber Heard.
Yeah, I think
with
so.
The cowboy hat and the jean jacket.
Yeah, so somebody asked him in an interview, did you know that your wine expenses are like $10,000 a month? And he replied, oh, wow, I thought it would be more.
What a douchebag.
Yeah, so that's the kind of guy we're dealing with. But he also said in the interview, the critics will go back on this in a couple years and they will see that they've made a mistake. And I don't think any critic has thought back on their review of Lone Ranger and been like, oh my God, I made a mistake. That's such a good movie.
Honestly, I doubt they even remembered they reviewed it.
Yeah, they're probably like, did I see that movie? I don't know if I did.
Oh shit, Johnny Depp's in it? Maybe it's good. I hear he's good in Crimes of Grindelwald.
Yeah. So all of the sequels were squashed. Disney halted development on the sequel, and
was that because of the revenue?
It was because of the revenue. Yeah.
Okay.
There also was some concerns with the whitewashing of Johnny Depp playing a Native American person.
Yeah.
So, which, I mean, I see the point, but I thought Johnny Depp was decent in the movie. I didn't hate his character.
Is Johnny Depp white?
He's not Native American, I don't think.
He's not Native American, but is he white?
Yeah. If anything, he looks Dutch, which he is part Dutch. So I guess I could see that. But he does look a little foreign. Maybe that's why he thought he could play a Native American.
Maybe that's why he thought. Yeah.
He's like, I don't look 100% white. I could play a Native American. They should have got Michael Pena.
He's also like full white.
If they were gonna, if they were gonna put anybody in the role, like Michael Pena has proven himself to be a great sidekick.
Awesome. Now we're gonna go ahead and transition over to our franchises that blew up. And for me, my two franchises are kind of weird because they blew up, but they kind of blew up for no reason. And my first one, I'm specifically talking about RoboCop. RoboCop becoming a franchise is a bit of a roller coaster ride. As we all know, the movie was rebooted in 2014. And in a way, this kind of counts as a franchise that both boomed and failed.
Yeah, it got a twofer.
Yeah. Failed specifically in 2014 with horrendous reviews and poor box office performance. I mean, that's kind of what you get when you put in fucking forgettable tall white guy number three, Joel Kinnaman.
Yeah. I'm proud to say that I have still never seen the new RoboCop, and I'm not going to. I don't want to ruin the nostalgia of the 80s RoboCop.
Same. Still haven't seen 2014. But as we discussed time and again, the studio, for some reason, thinks that because they've hired the original writers of RoboCop in 1987, Ed Neumeier and Michael Miner, somehow we'd be interested in this direct sequel to the 2014 film, which is supposedly going to be directed by Kevin's obsession, Neil Blomkamp.
Yes.
Did you know this, that they were going to make a sequel to the 2014 movie?
No, I didn't.
Do you think the series gets rebooted and goes from Detroit to South Africa? Because that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. And I'm thinking like a District 9 tie-in, District 10.
Yeah.
Because we're all jonesing for that.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. But I digress. So let's go back to 1987 when RoboCop first came out and was a huge hit in the summer of 1987. Initially, the RoboCop we know today wasn't even supposed to happen. The director, Paul Verhoeven, and aside from RoboCop, you may know him from directing Starship Troopers and Total Recall.
Both decent sci-fi movies.
Yeah, I would agree.
At the time, very good, but none of them hold up.
No, absolutely not. Zero. RoboCop may be it doesn't hold up, but it's still good, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense.
But Paul Verhoeven was the third person approached to make the movie. According to Verhoeven, he was unimpressed with the script almost immediately. He thought it was quote, terrible and completely ridiculous, and threw it away, end quote. His wife ended up reading it and told him that he needed to reconsider, and he did. And then he made RoboCop. And it's crazy how during the opening weekend, the movie made $8 million, which is $17 million in 2018. And that was number one in the spot.
Wow.
And what followed RoboCop...
When did it come out? Like a fucking Tuesday night December?
No, I think it came out in August, I believe, of 87.
So it was still a summer movie.
The number two summer movie that weekend was a re-release of Snow White and of the Seven Dwarfs.
Huh. Okay. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Unless people were not going to the movies back then.
No. Another little film called The Predator, or Predator, not The Predator, that's the new one, that I'll be covering, spoilers, came in 14th for the box office almost a month later of its release. That just goes to show, I guess people just weren't going to the movies as they are now.
I guess not. You know what's crazy? I always think of that scene from Entourage where they find out that Aquaman beat Spider-Man for $100 million for opening weekend. And I think, like, what were they doing in the 80s? Were they, like, going into a boardroom and, like, we're at 18 million, yes! And everybody, like, cheers, throws their papers up. And it's just, like, the best thing ever. Now it's, like, 18 million will probably get your, like, executive
the
fired.
Actor pay. Dude, I think 18 million would basically just bankrupt. Like, Fox would be purchased by fucking Sony or something.
Yeah.
It's ironic because for RoboCop, Arnold was considered for the role, which would have probably launched even further, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe not, because I don't know.
Was this before Terminator?
Yeah, 84.
84, wow.
He would have just Terminator the shit out of it.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been mad at that. That probably would have made RoboCop in it like worldwide sensation.
Yeah, probably. The gross domestic profit though was $53 million compared to $117 million today. RoboCop was also nominated for 3 Oscars and 1 for Best Sound Effects Editing. It was also nominated for Film Editing and Sound Mixing. But the fact that that this franchise blew up kind of blows my mind just based on the box office numbers. It was only ranked number 1 for 2 consecutive weeks, which I feel is kind of weak considering that, you know, number 2 slot was Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And the 3rd spot was Jaws, The Revenge, which is like the shittiest one.
Is that the 3rd one?
That's the 4th one.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And the 2nd week, there was no new big releases. But on the 3rd week of RoboCop being out, it dropped to number 4, losing to the James Bond flick, The Living Daylights, vampire film The Lost Boys, and biopic La Bamba.
I like La Bamba.
Isn't that with Neil Diamond?
Yeah, Neil Diamond Patrick Harris or something.
Neil Diamond Patrick Harris Phillips.
Yeah.
The guy has 50 names. Let's be real.
Is it Lou Diamond Phillips?
I think it's Lou Diamond
Okay, Phillips. I just had to think for 10 minutes to get that.
As far as RoboCop, though, I mean, I really love the movie, but I thought it was way more appreciated than what the stats let on.
Yeah, it seems like based off the numbers that it was dog shit.
It does. But it does.
It's a great movie.
But yeah, so obviously, I guess because this was a huge success for the studio, Orion, it wanted a sequel right away because of the success of the first film. And according to Ed Neumeier, the writer of RoboCop, Orion wanted a sequel right away, not only because of the success of the first film, but also because Orion was in financial trouble and needed another hit. Funny enough, Orion distributed Silence of the Lambs in 1991, ending up being a bigger hit than the eventual RoboCop 2, which also came out in 1990. Maybe it was also 1991. I can't remember.
Maybe 90 or 91.
But RoboCop 2 ended up grossing $12 million less than the first film.
Damn, it's hard to believe that Orion is like bankrupt now. As of like 95, yeah. They're bankrupt. Yeah. It's like you had like 3 hits out of 5 years and your company is just down the shitter.
Not existent. Yeah. I think that's probably because they're still trying to make a RoboCop film, even though they don't even own the rights anymore. But what had taken a couple of years for Neumeier and Miner, Orion wanted in a couple of months, a script in a couple of months. And so the writers came up with a rough draft in January of 88. And this is less than 6 months after the release of RoboCop 1.
Wow.
Yes.
Jeez. Give them a breather.
Yeah. Once they turned in the script, the writers' strike of 1988 had started in March. And both Neumeier and Miner, who at this point were pretty known writers because of RoboCop, they couldn't work on their draft submitted to Orion because the union would have just, I think the union would have dropped him. He would have lost his like health insurance, all this other stuff. So at this point, Orion approached comic book writer Frank Miller and hired him as the replacement for Neumeier and Miner. And Frank Miller was the one who revised their rough draft. Orion was able to work with Frank Miller just because the company that represented him had made a deal with the Writers Guild. And he was allowed to proceed with the project. That's why.
I was going to say, was he a fucking scab or something? Yeah. Crossing picket lines to write?
He's like, oh shit, this is my chance. RoboCop 2. But not only did the writers not partake in editing the draft they submitted, but the director of the first film, Paul Verhoeven, turned down the opportunity to direct the sequel. With no surprise, because it is 6 months later. He thought it would cheapen the feel of the original, especially considering that Orion wanted a sequel immediately. Verhoeven said they needed time to find something innovative again instead of cashing in, and after the original writers were no longer involved, he decided to leave the project.
That's a red flag right there. Just
it is a red flag, and yet Orion still continued, and they made RoboCop 2.
Yep.
They hired Empire Strikes Back director Irvin Kershner, And although it had a bigger opening weekend, like I previously mentioned, it made less money than RoboCop, the original. While the RoboCop franchise did technically blow up, it was forced to be blown up by the studio, as there was a third installment and an animated series. I think they just kept pumping out content saying, oh, we're a franchise now. But you're a failing franchise. You've been a failing franchise, despite it blowing up after the first one, just because you made it that way, you know?
I didn't know there was a cartoon.
Yeah, there was a cartoon.
I think there
were comic books as well.
Oh, yeah. There's comic books for everything nowadays.
There really is.
I know that because when I went to the comic book store with you, I saw a Donald Duck comic, and I read a couple of them while we were in the store.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that.
So my next one of a sequel or a franchise that blew up from nothing is Fast and Furious. And the reason I know you hate this franchise, but do you like the first movie? Do you at least like the first movie?
It has qualities that make me laugh, but I honestly think because I hate the latter one so much that I just hate this movie too, alongside of it.
Okay. Did you like it at the time?
Yeah, I liked it at the time. I also liked Tokyo Drift at the time, if I'm being 100% honest.
Okay. So the way that this movie got franchised is a bit of a roller coaster. It went from dying to revived and then to a new franchise. So basically how this became a franchise is that it did so well in the box office. It was made for $38 million and it made $207 million box office.
That's a fucking opening week. That domestic gross.
Yes, that's a ton for a movie. No, I'm just thinking like that's what Johnny Depp was trying to do with Lone Ranger, like make basically an indie movie, because $38 million, I would say anything made under $50 million is an indie movie.
The fact that we can say Fast and Furious started out as an indie movie and has become this is a...
Yeah.
That's a fucking statement.
You know, it's funny because I was reading some quotes from Vin Diesel talking about Too Fast, Too Furious, and his thought process on why he didn't want to do Too Fast, Too Furious was that he didn't want them to take the Fast and Furious name and throw it onto something that wasn't really related to the first movie. So it's funny that he said that, but that's exactly what they're doing in like Fast and Furious 6, 7,
all of them.
8, yeah.
Even 5. Even I think 4 may be the closest thing in retrospect to the original.
Fast and Furious. Yeah, that is probably that should be Fast and Furious 2.
I think maybe the first to middle part of the movie is closest to Fast and Furious 1.
Yeah, that is also...
It transitions to the new Fast and Furious.
Yeah, exactly. With all the explosions, the...
You know what? I thought I'd never say this. I think Tokyo Drift has more in common with the first one than any of the others in the franchise.
I think you're right.
That's probably why I like Tokyo Drift.
Yeah. So the whole reason the franchise came about was John Singleton, the director of the second movie, Too Fast, Too Furious. He saw the first movie and he said, damn, why didn't I think of that? He grew up in South Central LA, so they always had street races, and he wanted to continue that on. So what did he do? He took it to Miami. So they tried to get all the actors that were in the first movie, but Vin Diesel didn't want to do it. He was offered $25 million for the role, and he didn't want to do it. So they...
What was Vin Diesel doing at this time? Why is he being so picky? Was he doing like Triple X? Because I mean,
no, he was doing the first Riddick movie, Pitch Black.
Oh, okay. So he was trying to do his own franchise.
Yeah, he was trying to do his own shit. Okay. So they got the franchise. They got one of the writers from the first movie to return, and they wrote the movie. They had Tyrese in it. And they wanted Ja Rule to come back, so they offered him $500,000 to to be in the movie.
That's Ja Rule money. That's Ja Rule money right there.
And apparently Ja Rule did not return any of the calls for the studio, so they got Ludacris. And that's why we have Ludacris. So actually,
Ja Rule... He never responded. What if he like lost? Because I would believe that like Ja Rule lost his phone.
He left it at the club or something.
Yeah.
He gets his phone. He's got like 30 missed calls from his agent.
Do you think he would have blown up? Do you think Ludacris would have not like been in faded into obscurity? I feel like Fast and Furious was either going to propel one of these two people. Unfortunately for Ja Rule, it was not him.
Well, yeah, I think that Ja Rule could be in Ludacris's shoes right now because, you know, prior to this, Ludacris was just a rapper who wasn't like super mainstream at the time. And he had this was his first acting gig. So he was in this. This propelled him onto other stuff. And now he's doing Fast and Furious. He's making millions and millions of dollars. And where the fuck is Ja Rule now?
Yeah. I mean, but can you really see Ja Rule being like the super techie guy that
no
because Ludacris went from being a mechanic, owning like a shop and running street races to a straight up like black hat hacker.
Yeah. I can't even see Ja Rule doing mechanic work. Word.
Or Excel.
Yeah. Vin Diesel turned it down, like I said, but he said later on that he wishes he would have done the movie because he thinks that he owed it to the fans to bring the character back and do the best movie that he could, which I respect that.
I do, but think of the cameo end credit scene, if you will, of Tokyo Drift when he drives up. I got hyped.
Yes,
I got really hyped.
Yes. So yeah, I'll get to that. So the Too Fast, Too Furious did not do well in the box office. It was not considered a flop, but it didn't do great.
And this is when Vin Diesel said that.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That was right around that time. So Justin Lin wanted to take it in a different direction with Tokyo Drift. And the number one person they wanted to star in this movie was Vin Diesel. Vin Diesel was supposed to be the lead character in Tokyo Drift.
Really?
Yes. It's kind of the plot for the Vin Diesel Tokyo Drift was that he needs to learn drifting in order to solve a murder. That's the legit synopsis that I got from...
Like, that script was ahead of its time, because that's a Fast and Furious 12.
Yeah.
That's a Fast and Furious 12 plot right there.
They can bring it back.
They could.
So Vin Diesel backed out, and they got Lucas Black. The movie did really bad, and it tested for audiences, and they hated it. And the only way that they felt like they could revive the franchise was to try to get Vin Diesel for a cameo. And he didn't want to do it, but he wanted the rights to the Riddick series. So he bargained with them and said,
really? Oh, wow.
If you give me the rights to the Riddick series, I will do this cameo at the end of Tokyo Drift. So they gave him the rights, and that's why we have like 2015, 14's Riddick. He made that movie. He produced it all.
Oh, that's the really shitty one, though, right?
That's the most recent one. It's the R-rated one.
Okay. Okay. So not Chronicles of Riddick, because that one was awesome.
No, just it's Riddick. I think it was 2015.
It was basically like a remake of Pitch Black, though.
I think so, but it was, yeah.
But it was still a canon.
Yeah.
Of the Riddick series.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense, because that movie's horrible.
Yeah. So basically they used Vin Diesel's cameo in Tokyo Drift to launch the new franchise. So
yeah, that was the franchise launcher.
Yeah, it technically was, because they kind of, you know, they stumbled into two. Three didn't do well, and if Vin Diesel didn't do that cameo, we probably wouldn't have any more Fast and Furious movies.
So we have to blame Riddick.
Yeah, we have to blame Riddick on the entire Fast and Furious franchise.
Oh, that's sad. But at the same time, having said that, Vin Diesel back in, what was this, like 2003?
Yeah.
Is very different from Vin Diesel, the modern man. Because you know that, I guarantee you, they probably threw that script with the drifting and learning how to solve a murder in an archive somewhere.
On
the studio grounds. And they're going to pull it out and be like, Vin, which is, to not call him by his full name, I feel like is lunacy.
Vin Diesel.
So, Fast and Furious 11 has just come out. We're thinking of doing a anthology series with just Vin Toretto, and he's just like, oh yeah, fuck yeah. And they're like, so you go back to Japan and you learn how to drift to solve a long lost Japanese friend's murder. And he's like, I'm in. Let's do it. He's part of my family. And that's how we get Fast and Furious 12. Vince Toretto goes to Japan or something. I don't know.
Isn't his name Dom in the movie? Dominic?
You're right, it is. Completely new character. You're playing his twin brother, Vin Toretto.
Do you think at that point he would realize that he already read that script? Or is he just seeing dollar signs right now?
I think he's seeing dollar signs.
Yeah. He's like, damn, that is an original idea.
Who the fuck would need to drift to solve a murder? That is so original. It's funny because after choosing my last two franchises that blew up, I slowly started to realize that both blew up from the first movie and basically ended there. But my next movie I'm talking about is Predator. The sequels have just existed because of Hollywood studios' incessant need to shove more content down people's throats for the sake of nostalgia that only happened a couple of years or even a year after. So the Predator franchise was given a green light due to the success of John McTiernan's Predator in 1987. The opening weekend made $12 million, 26 mil today. And the domestic gross was $59,132,000 today. And due to the success of the film, Fox approached the screenwriters to make a sequel. One of the original scenarios for the Predator franchise to turn to was a sequel with Arnold Schwarzenegger returning as Dutch and battling another Predator, except Arnold now has alien tech at his disposal.
Oh, shit. District 9 stuff right there.
Yeah. This movie already sounds way better than what we actually got as Predator 2. There was an issue, however, as Arnold's idea of the movie and a salary dispute came into play. So the producer of Predator, John Davis, said that Arnold got shafted on his salary on the first movie for $250,000.
Wow.
And then when they talked of him appearing in the sequel, so did that $250,000, which Fox did not want to pay him to do the sequel.
They didn't want to pay him $250,000? Now
correct.
That's like a slap in the face if you get $250,000.
And by the way, this is in 1987 or 88 when Arnold Schwarzenegger is arguably probably the biggest fucking action star.
Yeah.
I mean, even still.
I feel like that's like a no-brainer. $250,000?
Yeah.
Like, it could at least ask for four or five.
I think the movie was made relatively cheap, so maybe they wanted to keep the low cost but get the same amount of money in. I don't really know.
Yeah.
But after Arnold obviously dropped out, screenwriters Jim and John Thomas thought of making The Predator a sort of anthology series, with Predator 2 taking place during World War II, a.k.a. Predator World War II in HD.
That what?
No, the Predator? That's a joke.
Okay.
But no. Well, the title's a joke. Predator in World War II is not the joke. That was actually a concept that they had.
Oh, okay. I was like, wait, the movie with Danny Glover takes place in World War II?
Yes, World War II.
I must
II,
have really
Jamaicans
missed
versus Colombians, because that's all it was.
I must have really missed the plot of that movie.
But yeah, in all seriousness, Predator 2 is going to take place during the snowy Battle of the Bulge and feature Nazis and Americans teaming up to kill the Predator.
That actually sounds cool.
It does. It does. I like it. But the studio didn't, and they then pitched the idea of an urban jungle to the studio, which, as opposed to an actual jungle, and the studio liked it, and the script was developed in 3 weeks.
Ooh. Somebody read Vicky King's How to Write a Movie in 21 Days.
Is that an actual book?
It is an actual book, yeah. They talk about it
is
in
it
Sopranos.
Helpful?
Yeah, it is helpful.
Oh, shit. This is where things start to make less sense on how this franchise has made it this far, because Joel Silver, the producer for Predator, Die Hard, Matrix. It's pretty yeah. decent films.
Lots of cool action movies.
Yeah. He decides to approach Stephen Hopkins for the direction of Predator 2. If you don't know who Stephen Hopkins is, I don't blame you.
I don't.
But at the same time, his only true directing gig was the fifth installment of Nightmare on Elm Street, The Dream Child.
Oh, God.
And I'm sure people don't really know this movie either, but it got mostly negative reviews and nominated for Razzies, and still they thought, yep, this is a good idea. Let's approach him. The rest is basically history, and we get Predator 2 that features warring voodoo gangs and crack-addicted Colombians, some insane violence, crazy Bill Paxton performances, and Danny Glover playing his character, Murtaugh from Lethal Weapon, like some bizarro crossover. But yeah, it's weird because the first film was a horror movie. John McTiernan said that it was a horror movie through and through. And I think there's no doubt about it, but the second is a balls-to-the-wall crazy action movie, completely separating itself from the style of the first film.
Yeah, the second one I don't really consider a horror movie. The first one I do.
Yeah.
But the second one is just like a sci-fi action movie.
It is. It's like a weird action movie, though, because I feel like there was a lot of weird like violence. Not like... It was just weird violence.
It was an awkward it was an awkward type of violence.
It was. It was. I will say that this franchise, though, despite it completely changing gears, it operates like a horror franchise. It was a good first movie with a unique and awesome monster. But then it quickly went to the audience just watching murder generic meat bags. That's like all it became.
Yeah.
Which is like most monster or slasher movies. It's a really cool monster villain that just ends up murdering people in the next installments. And there's basically no story, and everyone you watch, you hate. And then we also get Alien vs. Predator and the sequel to that, which is Alien vs. Predator Requiem, which is probably the worst of the franchise, personally. And then we get 2010's Under the Radar Predators, and most recently Shane Black's The Predator, which flopped. I don't know. Like, these are just like, it's just that horror feeling. We have an awesome character, but no true story behind it. We get a lot of like predator lore, but we still need good human characters to support a monster movie.
Yeah. They need to go like the Neil Blomkamp route. Indie and like heavy on the main actors. Yeah. And the lore, and I think you have a gold mine right there.
Yeah.
But they keep trying to do blockbuster like horror action movies, like more action than horror.
Yeah.
And I feel like the root of Predator is a straight up horror movie. And they've gotten too far away from that for it to be successful now.
I was going to say, and I think if they even tried to remake it, because I know they tried to go the horror route with Predators, with Adrian Brody, but that movie quickly just got away with itself. And I don't know. I just think that it's one of those movies that just, it was ahead of its time, but now it's just one of those things that just, even though the monster is really cool, it just can't be remade. Let it be like, fucking Creature of the Black Lagoon. Let it be like, oh, that was a cool looking monster, and just leave it at that.
Yeah. They're never going to do that.
Oh, of course not. But I mean, even Arnold, who's appeared in his fair share of shit movies, has said of this particular franchise that sometimes studios screw it up bad, and it all has to do with greed. And sometimes they want to do it really cheap and make as much money as possible, which is probably the truest thing he's probably said.
That's disheartening, because I think the first one is so good, and the second one is like so misguided and spastic that it's like,
I hate the second one. A lot.
I do too. So my last one is Toy Story. And if you didn't know, Toy Story was never supposed to be a franchise or even a sequel. There's never supposed to be any other Toy Story movies.
It ends pretty happily.
Yeah, it has a pretty good ending. But the reason we have a sequel is technically because of Aladdin's sequel, The Return of Jafar.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. So Toy Story came out in 1995. A year before that, 1994, Aladdin, came, the sequel to Aladdin came out and smashed box office records. It made like it made profits of $100 million in the theatrical run.
Have you seen Aladdin 2, Return of Jafar?
I haven't seen it in probably like 20 or more years.
Okay. Well, there's one thing I always remember about Disney animated sequels is that the animation for the sequel is dog shit.
Really?
Yeah. I tell you to look side-by-side comparison of an Aladdin frame of picture and an Aladdin Return of Jafar picture. It's like, it was made for TV. It's honestly really sad.
Wow.
Because I don't mind Return of Jafar. I think it's a pretty good movie.
I think it is,
from
too.
From memory.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that, direct to TV, because they were actually kicking around the idea of making a direct-to-VHS Toy Story sequel right around the time the first one came out. They weren't sure if it was going to be computer animated like the first one or if it was going to be like a Disney animation, you know, just completely abandon the whole computer animation thing.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so the whole idea of the sequel came about, or the reason the sequel got pushed forward was because the director of the first movie, and he was a big high up at the time, John Lasseter, he directed like Toy Story 1, 2, A Bug's Life.
He's like the Pixar guy.
Yeah, he's like the Disney Pixar guy, all the animation stuff he's been involved in. So he's in an airport, and it's a few weeks after Toy Story releases. He's in an airport, and he sees a child who has a Woody doll. And the kid was playing with his dad with this Woody doll, and he was so touched by the excitement that the kid had that he thought he wanted to make another movie and tell another story with Woody. I don't know what the motivations are, because in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, yeah, franchising. Merchandise.
That's what he was thinking. Let's be real. Yeah. He's like, oh shit, we have a fucking gold mine on our hands.
Yep. So they start working on Toy Story 2, and at that point it is a direct-to-video movie. The bigwigs at Walt Disney Studios at the time saw some of the rough cuts and some of the ideas for the sequel, and they loved it so much that they bumped it up to a wide release and put more people from the team at Pixar on the movie.
That may be the first time in the history of film where a movie was supposed to go straight to VHS and then became a fucking major motion picture.
Yeah. It's crazy to think that Toy Story's sequel could have had Disney animation and been straight to VHS.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people, I'm not really in this court, but a lot of people think that the second one is better than the first one.
And yeah, that's
I think they both have 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Do they really?
I think it's only two movies in a franchise to ever have 100%.
Wow. I mean, I'm partial to one.
I like one better.
Yeah. But yeah, that's a big argument that two is better than one.
Yep. So they had a bunch of ideas for the movie, and they had some of it planned out, but they didn't know if Tim Allen or Tom Hanks were even available or if they could even afford them. When Disney bumped it up to a wide release, they gave them a bigger budget. They were able to go get Tim Allen and Tom Hanks. And the rest is kind of history. They announced in 97 that they were going on with Toy Story 2. Toy Story 2 did so well that they franchised it and made a third one.
No, I was
going
to say that this is probably one of like the most popular animated franchises too.
Yeah. And it's crazy to think that Toy Story came out in 94, and it was also the first computer animated movie, because it still holds up. It still holds up. Yeah,
because I know the first time, like one of the first times, it was. It's not like with CG. It's just like a computer animated.
Yeah, it's like an animation program. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the first computer animation movie, 100% animation, and
it is kind of crazy that it still holds up, because I feel like there's a lot of computer animated movies that probably came out 6 or 7 years ago, and they look like Play-Doh. They look like the prelim animation before they start adding texture and additional details and shaders and shit like that.
Yeah. No, but it definitely holds up. I watched a few clips of it recently to get some nostalgia, and it was surprisingly still very, very good quality.
Okay, that's good to know. All right, awesome, man. Well, before we wrap things up, I wanted to ask you one final question, and this is a little spin on franchises, but if you could have a movie franchise on a real life business franchise, what would it be? Excluding the McDonald's movie, The Founder with Michael Keaton.
Oh, damn it.
You have three options. 7-Eleven, KFC, or Wendy's.
Do I have to pick the movie too?
You can do whatever you want. Yeah.
I would pick 7-Eleven.
Okay, so why 7-Eleven?
Slurpee brand. And I just feel like convenience stores, gas, that's where it's at.
Yeah.
And I would franchise with the Clerks movie.
Okay. So I was going to do like an original franchise for 7-Eleven because I wanted to see like a founder type thing where it starts off as this really cool, like, you know, like a drugstore from like the 50s, like a soda pop store.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like very classy. And then it's basically like the evolution of a 7-Eleven. So it starts off in like the fucking whenever 7-Eleven was found in like the 30s or something. And it keeps going and it just gets worse and worse. And there's like crack addicts hanging outside of it and then bums. And then next thing you know, it gets, you know, the nasty, shitty hot dogs that are consistently rolling. And that's the whole franchise is the timeline of 7-Eleven.
I actually like that because I was a big fan of The Founder and I'd like to see that about other franchises.
Yeah, there you go. 7-Eleven's the next one. But guys, let us know what your movie franchise of a real-life business franchise would be. And I guess you could pick outside of the box, but yeah, 7-Eleven, KFC, Wendy's, which one? And as always, thanks again so much for sticking around for the end of the show. If you want to give us a follow on Twitter and Instagram at Wicked Hot Talk for all of your Wicked Hot Movie Mayhem status updates and news, go ahead and click that follow button. And if you could give us a 5-star review and subscribe on iTunes and wherever a podcast can be found. This was another great week. We will see you in 2 weeks for another new episode of Movie Mayhem with Wicked Hot.
Bye, everybody.